It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning. The pregnant pause. It's your turn, Mike.
I guess we should deliver something, huh? Uh-huh. All right. So plenty of stuff to cover this week. I've been shorting you a minute the last couple weeks because we've just been running over. And now
what?
Oh, that's never mind. If you didn't notice, I'm not gonna.
Don't point it out now.
All right, so let's start out and deal with some local issues here first. Seattle schools.
Yes, the Seattle schools have a new superintendent, the leader. Which
is this someone from all that selection process?
No, as a matter of fact, it's not. But fortunately, in the wisdom of the current school board, they left a gift with us because they're afraid that they're not going to be around, or many of them won't be around another 3 weeks. This was a process where a lot of people associated with the school districts, parents and teachers and community activists, are saying they picked the wrong guy and absolutely the wrong manner. The person they did pick, Raj Manis, has been the acting superintendent. He's gotten reasonably good grades for the job that he's done as a caretaker since Olszewski first tendered his resignation and then left town a little bit early. But the problem is that once again, for the second time in a row, this is the same way that Olszewski was elevated without any kind of a search process, without being interviewed, at least publicly interviewed, specifically for the superintendent job, without a chance for any of the stakeholders in the district, whether that be the teachers or the principals or the parents or community leaders, politicians, whoever it is, to comment on whether this is appropriate. And it was done as an act of desperation. And actually, I had one school board candidate who begged me to remain unnamed, although it could really be just about any of them, say that the current school board acted out of spite, because they were afraid they're going to lose all their jobs in 3 weeks, and this was their way of getting back. This was a real rush job where the school board tried to ram through a selection process at a very awkward time of year. You're not going to get a very good pool of candidates for superintendent when the school year is just starting. Most superintendents, particularly with the specification of large troubled urban school districts that the search process specified, they're not going to be leaving their district right at the beginning of a school year. And so what you wound up with was a group of finalists that all had baggage. Several of them had been asked to leave their various school districts at different times. Three of them were no longer attached to actual school districts. They were in university or think tank type settings instead. And they all withdrew from the process because they saw that if they took the job, they would be in a no-win situation where so much of the community had not wanted them to be named, and where the people who did name them in all likelihood were going to be gone after November 4th.
And so their support would be gone.
Yeah, exactly. So that you have the president of the school board, Nancy Waldman, who got 40% of the vote in the primary in September, where her opponent, Breeder Butler-Law, got 51%. You had the chair of the finance committee, Steve Brown, who also lost in the primary and is in danger of being replaced by Darlene Flynn. And you can just go down the list where you have four very strong reform candidates running for four of the seven seats in November. You have a fifth person, Mary Bass, who's already on the school board in her first term.
I understand she was against this whole process.
She was against this whole process. She, as has been the case many times in the last 2 years, was the one in the 6-1 vote of wanting the school board to wait until after the election to get a new pool of candidates, to get a pool of candidates that had actually been properly vetted for things like why they had left their past school districts. The search firm in this process, Proactive of Milwaukee, just did a horrible job. We talked about that some last week. And the school board just rushed through and named Raj Manis anyway. The tendency in this case is going to be, after a year, well, he's been here a year, he's done an okay job, there's no reason not to keep him on, rather than go through a whole new search process. But the question at this point is twofold. Number one, what happens on November 4th? And I think, folks, if if people weren't convinced beforehand that this school district is not operating in the best interests of the children of the city, they need to be. And then the second question is, there's a school levy coming up in February that is going to be voting on a major chunk of funding for the school district. And once again, this is awful publicity, not just for the Seattle School District, but the whole notion of public education and whether people should support it, seeing how the decisions are made as to how our tax money is being spent. It really is essential, I think, for the levy to pass, that we get some new people running the school board and running the school district. And then people need to be making the case that this is not the way public schools should be run or will be run in the future.
Mm. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think we've all been getting a pretty good education on this of late. Let's just see if the voters learn anything.
Yeah, and you know,
right, it's switches.
And you know, it's kind of sad because I've been on the "this school board is abominable" drumbeat for 5 or 6 years now, and it really has taken these kind of crises and this kind of very high profile screwing up for much of the community to get that. It's just, you know, it's one of these cases where an agency that people don't pay too much attention to, the Port of Seattle is another good example, feels like it has the license to abuse the public trust.
Mm. Yeah, Port of Seattle, which there was a big article in the Seattle Times this morning about them looking at
Pier 91,
turning it into a nice upscale neighborhood.
Yeah, starting with that's over in Inner Bay for folks who are not familiar with that. Going all the way north up the waterfront,
Magnolia, Queen Anne.
Yes,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, well, let's jump to world news here, Maria. The World Climate Conference.
Yeah, there were a couple of climate-related news items this past week. The World Health Organization and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine came out with a report earlier this week saying that 160,000 people per year die from the effects of global warming.
But it's all a myth.
Yeah, it doesn't exist. But no, and that's just counting. They just counted deaths by malnutrition, diarrhea, malaria, and the spread of other tropical diseases in the wake of warmer temperatures. And they were mostly looking at Africa, Latin America, and Southeast Asia. And they said that the impact would be felt mostly by children in developing nations. So really they're talking about upwards of 150,000, 160,000, mostly children, who die every year currently from the effects of global warming.
And that's only in specific areas for specific causes. So
that's right. It's
an undercount, probably.
And they didn't include deaths from severe heat in northern latitudes. For example, people might remember that this year in France, some 15,000 people died from a severe heat wave. And that was just in France. The heat wave was all over Western Europe. And it doesn't look at deaths related to other kind of climate change things like hurricanes, tropical storms, typhoons, tornadoes, etc. And it doesn't look at other causes of other side effects of global warming that might cause deaths as well. Now, that report comes on the heels of the World Climate Change Conference, which was going on this week in Russia. Now, climate scientists and environmentalists had high hopes for this conference because the Kyoto Protocol, the Kyoto Treaty, is supposed to eventually go into effect once Russia ratifies it, would supposedly help put global warming in check. Now, some people argue that it's not enough, that you really would need more than the Kyoto Treaty to really halt global warming. But other people say, well, Kyoto is all that we have, and it's a start, and it would make a big difference as far as the rate of global warming. And then from there, we can look at other initiatives going forward that might actually reverse or halt global warming. So the Kyoto Treaty has been very important to climate scientists and to environmentalists. Well, this week in Russia, Vladimir Putin came out and said, well, sorry, we're not going to ratify it after all. We're going to wait. We're going to study it a bit longer because we're not totally convinced that global warming actually exists. Now, this is a position that the Bush administration has been putting a lot of pressure on Vladimir Putin to take. And so the folks in D.C. in the Bush administration are probably having a little party today about that fact that Vladimir Putin has put the Kyoto Treaty on hold, because once Russia really does ratify the treaty, which we can all hope that they will do eventually, then the treaty would go into effect and become international law and binding for its signatories at least, and hopefully for the rest of the world as well. Now, ironically, Vladimir Putin made this statement about global warming while his own hometown, the beautiful old Russian city of St. Petersburg, is currently building flood barriers to hold back the Baltic Sea, which is slowly rising and engulfing the city. So I think the question of whether or not global warming actually exists is not in question, that really Vladimir Putin is just looking at some economic help from the Bush administration. And he's also looking at, well, if the U.S. can sink the Kyoto Treaty because it might be a problem for their big business in America, well, who am I to do the same here in Russia? He's looking to the future. He's looking at his own campaign contributors, large corporations in Russia that are also putting pressure on him.
And there's also some internal dynamics in Russia that are important on this issue in terms of the deforestation in Siberia. That's been going on wholesale under Vladimir Putin, and much of that is with foreign corporations. And I mean, we've seen that here in the Northwest, where Weyerhaeuser has substantial holdings over in Siberia right now and are chopping down those forests as fast as they can.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
There was again, with our local papers, the local connection, I saw that Bush has taken off more rulings on like mining. Is that?
He has. The Bush administration has finally sunk a hole in the little ship that was keeping anti-mining activists afloat. The open pit mining, which is pretty much the standard now for particularly gold mining, corporations around the world that do
is?
Gold mining.
You want to describe what that is? Because it sounds much more innocuous than it is.
Open pit mining is basically where they go in with these enormous bulldozers and they just create a huge scar in the earth, a huge open pit mine, which can be miles in diameter. And then they take all the tailings, all of the dirt and rock that they've dug up, and they dump it on a big piece of land right next to the huge open scar in the earth. And then when the rains come, it leaches all of the heavy metals and acids out of those mine tailings, and it pollutes the groundwater, nearby groundwater, and causes an enormous mess for the communities surrounding the open pit mine. Now, the Clinton era, a court ruling had come down that said that for example, for every 20 acres of open pit mine, you can only have 5 acres of waste dirt next to it, and that it had to be nearby. Now, what happened is the Bush administration allowed this to be overturned, and now open pit companies that do open pit mines can take as much dirt out of the ground and put it over as much public land as they want. It doesn't have to be confined to every 5 acres for every 20 acres of mine. It can be every 20 acres or 30 acres or 50 acres of waste for every 20 acres of mine. And it can be spread anywhere. It does not have to be right next to the mine. It can be hauled to another community where the dirt is processed for the little bits of gold, little flecks of gold in it, and then the waste dumped anywhere.
Yeah, and this has been a huge issue for people who go over that way in northern Idaho, western Montana, and the northern Rockies. There's a lot of this type of mining that goes on, as well as in Appalachia and in the Great Basin, a number of places in the western U.S.
It also opens up the question of will the Buckhorn Mountain mine now be more viable? Folks might remember
Okanagan.
That the eastern Washington, Okanagan region, people have been fighting against the Buckhorn Mountain mine, which was meant to be an open pit mine, and it's been put on hold for more than a decade. Well, this law might reverse that, and that mine might actually go ahead.
All right. Jumping back to international news, Nobel Peace Prize was awarded this week.
Yeah, and as I was looking just before we went on air, and unfortunately I didn't have time to do it, I was hoping to have in my hand a list of recent Nobel Peace Prize winners, because it seems like many of them have been either personally critical of United States foreign policy, or the Nobel Peace Prize itself has been awarded, the committee has been critical of U.S. foreign policy. And this year was no different, but it's not being reported that way, interestingly enough, in the United States. The prize winner is a woman named Shireen Ebadi, who's an Iranian human rights lawyer who's been fighting against the theocracy there for 30 years. And the Peace Prize Committee made a pointed reference in awarding the prize to her of, this being the first time a Muslim woman has ever been awarded the Peace Prize, and that it's a strike both for human rights in Muslim countries and the rights of women, and women and children in particular have been the focus of her career. But the interesting part is that more recently, Ebadi has also been extremely critical of the United States threatening really to invade Iran is what's on the table, particularly because the United States has armies on both sides of Iran right now, in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Those are the eastern and western borders, respectively, of Iran. And she came out, she was in Paris when the prize was awarded, and in accepting the prize, she made two points. One was the rights of women and children in Muslim countries, and that human rights is not incompatible with Islam, the responsibility for human rights abuses and political prisoners and all the other things governments like Iran's have historically done, that responsibility rests with the government, not with the nature of Islam itself. And then the second point that she made was that there, which, as again, we've made on this program in the past, is that there is a large and vibrant pro-democracy movement in Iran, that it is a substantial part of the government at this point. In fact, there's been a pitch battle that's been going on in Iran politically for the past several years between modernists and reformists.
Which is why she's considered a reformist, because
yes,
these people are actually in the Iranian government trying to create these
exactly
reforms.
Exactly. And that the United States, by lumping all of Iran together as the axis of evil, and if we're going to sweep in and give this country democracy and so forth, is undermining the reformists. It's giving more ammunition to the hardliners that say there's no dealing with these maniacs in Washington, D.C. And also, it's a larger implication than Iran itself, because what we're seeing in Iran among the reformists, and, there's a multi party democracy in Iran right now, which is actually quite a bit more democratic than what we have in this country in many ways. But what we're seeing in Iran right now is democracy in a Muslim context. And if you're ever going to want to see democracy in the Middle East and in Arab and Muslim countries, which is what the neocons in Washington claim they want, it's going to have to be in a Muslim context. It's not going to be a Western-style democracy and take hold with any kind of meaningful way in civil society. So, the United States, really, if the Bush administration were about what it says it is about, would be trying to support reformists and people like Dr. Ebadi. Instead, instead, they find themselves on opposite sides of the fence, and somebody opposing U.S. policy has once again won the Nobel Peace Prize.
All right. Well, that takes us to a country right next to Iran, Iraq, for time once again for this week
in Iraq.
So, Maria.
I don't know about this theme music.
It's not working for you?
It might take away a little bit from the dignity
the
and seriousness.
So.
Oh, yes. Well, this week people might have seen some news on Iraq. It was Dick Cheney standing up in front of the Heritage Foundation and saying, all of those critics of our policy in Iraq really want us to do nothing, and Saddam Hussein would still be in power, and yada, 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 and things are really improving in Iraq.
We have more evidence than ever that he was working hand-in-hand with al-Qaeda, which is, I mean, what planet is he on?
Should provoke a laugh track by now. I mean, I think people can hear that and say, well, gosh, Dick Cheney
is lying.
He's either lying or he's delusional. He's had one too many heart attacks and has no more blood supply to his brain.
Bush has even come out and said the opposite of that, Don't they share space anytime during the week?
I think their neckties are wrapped a little too tightly around their necks, and the oxygen supply is just diminished
just
to their brain.
It's something. And really, I think he's just in the habit of lying now, and it's so hard to break that habit once you've started down that road.
They've convinced themselves of it, I think. They've got religion. They do.
Like I said last week, weapons of mass destruction, connections with al-Qaeda, it's a matter of faith, and they're going to keep, talking about the faith until everybody believes. Well,
Tell the big lie for long enough. And yeah.
Another lie this week was that things were improving in Iraq, particularly in the capital city of Baghdad and in the second city of Basra and other cities in Iraq, when in fact there were riots in Baghdad, Basra, Baiji, Kirkuk, and Hilla this week. And in fact, the protests and the rioting are getting worse.
And spreading among more people.
And spreading, yeah. They started over the weekend with former Iraqi soldiers. Folks might remember that when Paul Bremer was appointed as the viceroy to Iraq, one of the first things he did was he disbanded the entire Iraqi army. He didn't just send the officers home. He sent everybody home, and effectively putting hundreds of thousands of men with children and wives out of work. And those folks have now become a constant presence at U.S. headquarters in Basra and Baghdad, protesting, looking for work, and wanting pension payments that were promised to them. Now, some Iraqi soldiers have received pension payments, and many, many, many have not, because their names are not on a list, or the U.S. Provisional Authority runs out of money for the day, so they can't pay everybody, et cetera, et cetera. Well, there was a rumor, and I'm not sure if this really was a rumor or was actually truth, that last Saturday was the last day for pension payments for former Iraqi soldiers, and that provoked riots in both Basra and Baghdad and also in Kirkuk and Hilla. And what happened was several Iraqis were actually shot and killed in both Basra and in Baghdad. And again, this provoked more protests and more riots. Now, come Tuesday and Wednesday, there was a group of Shiite clerics that were going to meet with U.S. With the Coalition Provisional Authority regarding security reasons in Baghdad. What happened, however, is that someone in the U.S. military decided to arrest one of these Shiite clerics while he was on his way with about a dozen other men to this meeting. And this provoked enormous protests on Tuesday and Wednesday, upwards of 6,000 people marching in the street asking that this man be released because, you know, he had been arrested, in their view, for no reason. Now, on Thursday morning, there was a car bombing at a police station in the Shiite neighborhood of Baghdad that killed about 10 to 12 people. Now, one of the police sergeants at the site directly blamed a local Shiite cleric, and lo and behold, later in the day, there was an enormous shootout between U.S. soldiers and a Shiite militia in that same part of the city, and that has provoked enormous demonstrations ever since. There was upwards of 10,000 people marching in the streets of Baghdad yesterday on Friday to protest this. Now, what this means is because U.S. troops, there aren't enough troops in Iraq, they've had to rely on these militias being formed by various political parties to keep the order in places like this Shiite section of Baghdad. It's a Shiite militia. Now, the problem with that, when you allow that to happen, is that there's going to be clashes between the two sides, and that's what is going on now.
And sometimes there's more than two sides involved also. It winds up getting very complex.
Yeah, in fact, there were charges that Iraqi police were shooting into the crowd, that U.S. troops weren't actually responsible for many of the deaths. And so the question remains, now you've got this huge mess once you get all of these people with guns together.
And one of the other things that's complicating this and souring the general public on the United States is the Bush administration came out this week threatening to expel Al Jazeera and a couple of other Arab and Muslim television networks out of Iraq for what it characterizes anti-American reporting. Well, anti-American reporting in this case means reporting exactly the same types of things that you were just laying out, that, you know, much of what's going on right now in Iraq, although we're not hearing about it very much in our networks, is stuff that puts the United States government in a not particularly flattering light. And when you have the United States Ukraine's government threatening to suppress this kind of information so that, for example, when people are not only hearing that the pension payments are going to be cut off, but the United States is threatening news organizations for reporting this kind of information, it really evokes Saddam Hussein and his government-controlled media and tyranny and political prisoners and secret police and all the rest of the things that the Iranian people are now seeing unfold all over again in their country.
People. Yeah. And I just want to make one additional point that the protests in Baghdad in particular have gone from being former Iraqi troops to being Shiites. Now, folks will remember that the Shiites are the people who have been supporting the U.S. invasion. When you have upwards of 10,000 Shiite men marching in the streets, some of them with guns, many of them very, very angry and shouting things like, the U.S. troops get the hell out of our country, then you've got a real problem when U.S. troops have alienated the largest sector of the population, and it's the one group that has welcomed U.S. troops. So, yeah. As Jav was saying earlier when we were talking about that, well, we've managed to unite Iraq against us.
Yeah, if you have the Sunnis that previously comprised many of the demonstrations, and that was the power base of Saddam Hussein in the past. You now have the many of the Shiites up in arms with the United States as well, and you have the Kurds that are upset.
And the Kurds are upset because Turkey is wanting to send, has now voted to send troops into Iraq.
Into northern Iraq.
Yeah, and although the U.S. wants them to deploy in the Sunni Triangle, the Turks have said, no, we want to deploy them in northern Iraq, and that's alienated the Kurds completely.
Because the other half of the Kurdish population, or I guess the other third or so, is over the border in Turkey itself, and there's a long, long history of the Turkish government acting in really a pretty genocidal manner against the Turks within their own country.
Trying to prevent an autonomous Kurdish republic.
Yes. Just a couple minutes left. Maria, can you briefly mention some of the companies that are looking at cashing in on that $87 billion?
Oh, yeah. I have a little list of some of the companies that are lining up at the public trough to get some of that $87 billion that's winding its way through Congress. DynCorp wants to pay $240,000 per year for people to train Iraqi police.
And these are the same folks that are illicitly running the war in Colombia right now.
Yes. Vanel Corp, a subsidiary of Northrop Grumman, has the $48 million contract to train the Iraqi army. They're going to probably get another $165 million once this bill passes.
I think they're in Colombia, too.
Mm-hmm.
Caterpillar. Same pattern.
here's another company that might be familiar for people. Caterpillar, Inc. makes armored bulldozers for the Israeli military to use in knocking down Palestinian homes in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. They've already sent some 500 to 600 bulldozers to Iraq. Those bulldozers range in price from $100,000 to nearly $1 million each.
I believe that was one of the bulldozers that went over Rachel Corrie.
Yes, was a Caterpillar bulldozer.
And there's a quote of the week in this issue of Eat the State talking about how Israel provides an excellent model for how the United States should treat Iraqis.
Yeah. And then Bechtel is the lead contractor for most of the infrastructure rebuilding. That'll be water systems, irrigation systems, power plants, et cetera. All of that's going to come up to several billion dollars for Bechtel. And in addition, folks will remember that Kellogg Brown and Root, a subsidiary of Dick Cheney's former employer or company, however you want to put it, Halliburton, they have the no-bid contract to rebuild Iraq's oil infrastructure.
No-bid, meaning nobody else had a chance to get the money.
Yeah, which is going to run into the billions and billions of dollars.
Yep, pigs at the trough. Maybe we could use that as our theme music, just having the pigs lining
up. Just some oinks.
Yeah. Or old MacDonald
Oinks
had a farm.
And grunts.
All right, we can work on that. All right, with that, we're pretty much out of time. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places where you find free media and free publications. We can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate. That's all one word, eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, want to volunteer, you found another name of another company that's going to make money off of Iraq, you can give us a call and let us know at 206-903-9461.